This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
An uneasy ceasefire prevailed in South Sudan's capital on Tuesday as aid workers struggled to reach thousands affected by heavy clashes of the last few days. New fighting was reported in the countryside while the government and opposition traded accusations over who was at fault for the violence.
That's Jason Patinkin reporting on the current situation in South Sudan. Details coming up.
Also, the latest attempt to end Burundi's political crisis and violence has failed. And in Zimbabwe, a video of a police officer beating a woman has gone viral.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, an uneasy ceasefire is in place in South Sudan's capital, Juba, today. Humanitarian agencies are trying to reach thousands of people affected by heavy fighting over the past few days. New fighting was reported today in the countryside, while the government and opposition blame each other for the violence. Jason Patinkin reports from VOA's East Africa Bureau in Nairobi.
Tuesday was calm in Juba, but Gregor Miller of the International Committee of the Red Cross told VOA by phone that the situation is far from resolved.
Fighting of the last few days has displaced thousands of people who are on the move or have sought shelter in different sites across town, notably around churches and in humanitarian compounds. They are in need of shelter, of water, of food, of medical care.
Miller said the ICRC and the South Sudan Red Cross are distributing food and medical supplies while also helping bury dead bodies which accumulated in the streets. President Salva Kiir declared a ceasefire Monday after pushing opposition fighters from their base in the Jebel region of the city. Opposition leader Riek Machar soon followed suit with a ceasefire order of his own. Now there is a blame game over who started the clashes, which have left hundreds dead. South Sudan's ambassador to Kenya, Chol Ajongo, says the opposition started it. He also slammed a peace agreement which Kiir and Machar signed last August under intense international pressure. He said the government did not want to agree to allow the former rebels to return to the capital.
We accepted it, and this is what we got.
However, the opposition accused the government of being at fault for the renewed conflict. The fighting erupted in Juba last Thursday. The government says opposition fighters killed five soldiers at a checkpoint. In the following days, the government used helicopters and tanks against the opposition, which carried only light weapons and whose troop strength in Juba was limited by terms of the peace deal. During the fighting, the government shelled a UN compound protecting thousands of Nuer civilians, the same ethnicity as opposition leader Machar. The UN's Special Representative for Prevention of Genocide said Tuesday that there were reports of civilians targeted for their ethnicity. The UN has called for more troops from the region to be sent to bolster the UN peacekeeping mission in South Sudan, which is meant to protect civilians. Government forces have blocked the peacekeepers from patrolling the city. But Ambassador Ajongo said no more foreign peacekeepers should be sent to South Sudan. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Jason. In related news, the UN Refugee Agency is calling on all armed parties in South Sudan to allow safe passage for people who fled the fighting in Juba in recent days. The UNHCR also is urging South Sudan's neighbors to keep their borders open for a possible increase in refugees. While calm is generally reported today, the agency says the fighting had displaced about 36,000 people.
The latest attempt to end Burundi's political crisis and violence has failed. AFP reports government representatives stayed away from peace talks in Tanzania today because of the presence of leading opposition and civil society figures. The government accuses them of supporting an attempted coup. the inter-Burundi dialogue has been plagued by delays from the start. Hundreds of people have been killed since April of last year after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term. Nearly 300,000 people have fled to neighboring countries.
Zimbabwe, video of a police officer beating a woman has gone viral. The incident happened last Friday in a suburb of the capital, Harare. The woman is among others sitting on the ground. She offered no resistance. Her daughter watched and cried and then put herself between her mother and the police officer. Reporter Peter Thornycroft is following the story. From Johannesburg, she spoke with VOA's Joe DeCapua about the video.
There is a young woman who was sitting down in the edge of the frame, and she is being attacked by policemen with either a baton or a stick, and she's being attacked on the soles of her feet. She's repeatedly suffering injuries to her feet. She's been beaten again and again and again. And this is a form of torture that the Zimbabwe Republic Police have used for several years. It's known locally as falanga. It often doesn't break the skin of the feet, but the bones in the feet are often broken and damaged. And we know people who have suffered lifelong injuries. They've never been able to heal their feet from this beating from the police. Around the woman are some other people, and her child is sitting watching her mother being beaten and, of course, whimpering and crying. This took place in a suburb to the southeast of Harare called Epworth on Friday. And it is a very clear video, and of course, it has gone viral.
Peter, I saw the video in question, and it appeared in the video that the police officer who beat the woman on her feet was smiling after he did it. Do we know who took this video?
We suspect, from what we have seen so far, that this video was taken with a mobile phone by a policeman on the back of an official police truck. We've been told this by several well-informed contacts, and we do see the police laughing. I think that has shocked many people around the world, and especially those with video phones in Zimbabwe who are able to see what is done by the police.
Any idea how this video became public?
We don't know how the video became public. It was obviously sent to Evan Mawarira, who runs a site called This Flag since April. That's his hashtag, This Flag. He began running the site because he was in despair when he said he couldn't pay his children's school fees. And he has been putting out pieces of information, particularly in advance of last week's stay away, when most people, at least in the cities, did not go to work in private limited companies, including all the private schools, the banks, and the streets were deserted and supermarkets were empty. So that was the demonstration that Evan Mawarire called for. And he, of course, is now arrested.
So, Peter, now that this video has become public and gone viral in many countries, what's the next step? Is there any legal action that might be taken against the police?
We don't know yet whether anybody in Zimbabwe is going to take any legal action until we know the identities of those policemen involved. But human rights activists in Harare who have seen this video say they will be forwarding a copy to the United Nations because Zimbabwe Republic Police have for years been selected to serve as peacekeepers in various parts of the world. And this is a very popular job because they get paid in US dollars a great deal more than their local salaries. Human rights activists are telling us that this is the proof that they've wanted for years to show that there is an element within the Zimbabwe Republic Police who do torture and who enjoy it.
That's reporter Peter Thornycroft from Johannesburg. She spoke with VOA's Joe DeCapua. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehiz Wuhib, 15 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. An uneasy ceasefire is in place in South Sudan's capital, Juba, today. The latest attempt to end Burundi's political crisis and violence has failed. And a video of Zimbabwe police officers beating a woman has gone viral. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
The UN-backed Libyan Government of National Accord, or GNA, moved today to its official headquarters in Tripoli. For over 3 months, it had been located at a naval base. Last week, the U.S. and several European countries have expressed emphasizing their continued support for the GNA. However, some experts doubt it can unite competing political forces in the country. Jason Pacht is the founder of the website called Eye on ISIS in Libya. He told VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi that the U.S. should not rely solely on the GNA to uproot ISIS from Libyan territories.
We haven't had a coherent policy towards Libya pretty much since the fall of the Gaddafi regime in 2011. And in fact, the U.S. has taken increasingly a back seat to the U.N. And the U.N. had a strategy of trying to bring together the Eastern faction based in Tobruk, which is connected with General Haftar, and the Western factions connected with various Islamist groups and the Misratan militias. Unfortunately, the so-called unity government, or GNA, is not really a unity of these two groups. The unity government really represents only the interests in the west of the country. So it has achieved some things. It has gotten those groups to try to fight the Islamic State and CERT. And they've made real gains. However, they have not made those gains working with the Easterners, with General Haftar. So he conducts his own battles against the Islamic State, and he has his own fights with the Federalists over who controls the oil ports. What would be useful, in my view, would be to create a genuine anti-ISIS coalition, bringing together the three or four main forces, General Haftar in the east, the Federalists in the Oil Crescent, with the Misratans and other aspects of the unity government in the west.
What role do you see for the international community in fighting ISIS in Libya?
I don't believe the international community can lead the fight. The role I have for the international community, and the U.S. in particular, is to try to motivate and facilitate the Libyans in their fight to get their country back. And there was a moment in May and early June where that was working, that, yes, there are some French special forces and there are very small numbers of U.S. and U.K. special ops, but they're not fighting in the front lines. They're helping coordinate and giving satellite imagery or some human intelligence to the Libyan forces, particularly those of what's called the Banyan Marsous, or Solid Structure Operations Room. And this is useful, but it helps the Libyans feel ownership over that fight. Mm. One of the things that is going on now is people blame the Misratans. Oh, they're the pawns of the international community, and there is factional fighting in Libya. That's unfortunate. What the U.S. can do is to help, whether it's convening a conference or maybe providing funds or training to try to bring multiple groups together. So in short, I look at a political solution rather than a military one.
So what's your assessment of the GNA assault on CERT?
Well, we saw some gains. It seemed that the Islamic State collapsed from its coastal holdings. It used to hold about 300 kilometers of coastline surrounding CERT. Very quickly, they lost the territory between Misrata and CERT, areas like Abu Ghraib and then the power station and areas leading into CERT. That was encouraging. However, they've entrenched in central CERT, and it's difficult to get the Banyan Marsous groups to take heavy casualties. However, they are doing it. They're fighting, and we can't disparage those groups who are suffering casualties and continuing to fight against the Islamic State. So we can say that the Islamic State is definitely weakened and its ability to control territory and hopefully even conduct attacks is harmed. However, what we've seen in Iraq is that when the Islamic State has been harmed and is genuinely suffering, it conduct a revenge attack. So it wouldn't be that surprising to see car bombs or some kind of attack against maybe oil infrastructure. And that's disappointing, but that wouldn't mean that the offensive is not working.
That was Jack Pack, founder of the website Eye on ISIS in Libya. He spoke with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy.
South Africa has the largest number of people living with HIV, more than 6 million, according to the latest government statistics. It also has the biggest antiretroviral, or ARV, drug program in the world. Every month, the government provides medicine to more than 3 million people. The drugs boost their immune systems, protecting them against potentially fatal opportunistic infections and dramatically prolonging their lives. But in the not-too-distant past, the South African government refused to give ARVs to HIV-positive people. Then President Thabo Mbeki described the drugs as toxic. Researchers say this policy was responsible for at least 330,000 deaths. But some survived the period of AIDS denialism in South Africa, and reporter Darren Taylor in Johannesburg made one of them.
In 2000... 26-year-old health educator Yvette Raphael rose up in opposition to Thabo Mbeki's stance on ARVs. This was after the then-president had again questioned the efficacy of the drugs during the 13th International AIDS Conference in Durban, causing a storm of protest.
And believe you me, I joined that, not knowing that I was HIV positive.
A few months later, Raphael's health began deteriorating. Her skin broke out in rashes. She lost weight rapidly and was always tired. Raphael says she swallowed hard and decided to be tested for HIV.
The result came back positive, and I was given a few days to live. I was told I got AIDS and I was going to die not so long.
At the time, she says, being HIV positive in South Africa was a death sentence, because infected people couldn't access ARVs in the public sector. But Raphael was fortunate. Contacts in the activist community referred her to a private doctor who provided her with ARVs.
However, I did not get support in the private clinic. In the private sector, it was very, you know, impersonal. The doctor would just give you a treatment. There was no support groups for people living with HIV. There was nothing. So
Raphael then decided to venture into the impoverished townships surrounding Johannesburg. There, she says, someone was dying of AIDS-related sicknesses in every second tin shack. Her mission was to find solidarity with infected people, to support them and to be supported by them.
And that's where I met a lot of people who were dying of HIV. Every weekend, we were crying. Our support groups were big, up to 80, 90 people at that time, and we would bury our friends every weekend.
She promised her closest friends on their deathbeds that she'd care for their orphaned children. Raphael has lived up to her pledges.
I'm a mother of two children, but I'm also raising eight other children. So at any given time, I am looking after 10 kids.
Durban is once again preparing to host the International AIDS Conference starting on the 18th of July. In the build-up to the event, Raphael says analysts are quoting the statistics of people who died because of Mr. Mbeki's policy not to give them ARVs. But to people like her, these casualties will always be faces, not numbers.
They quote numbers like 300,000 people who died, 150,000 young children, babies born with HIV at the time. But it was bigger than that for some of us who were in the midst of things, you know. And it was a horrible time for us. It was a horrible time for me as well as somebody who had access to treatment, seeing my friends die.
Today, Thabo Mbeki still doubts the benefits of ARVs, something Raphael says is irrational given the scientifically proven effectiveness of the drugs.
This is 16 years since my diagnosis and since I started treatment. My initial goal was to just see my daughter go to daycare and not miss her mommy. Now my daughter is 16 years old and I'm looking forward to her graduation.
But she adds that she has mixed feelings about South Africa's massive antiretroviral drug rollout.
The fact that we have the biggest ARV program in the world should not be celebrated, because I think there's somewhere where we are going wrong in prevention. There's clearly no need for us to be still having so many new infections for young women and girls. 3,200 and some odd young women are still getting diagnosed with HIV every week.
South Africa still has the fastest growing HIV epidemic in the world. The country's Human Sciences Research Council says there are about 400,000 new infections every year. Raphael says her homeland has proven its ability to treat HIV, but not to prevent it.
Where are the campaigns targeting men to let them know the role they have in transmitting this HIV virus to young women?
Raphael says she'll be at the conference in Durban next month. There, she plans to appeal aggressively to donors to stop cutting funds aimed at preventing the spread of HIV and instead to invest more. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
The 27th Assembly of the African Union has opened in Kigali, Rwanda, with the theme 2016 Year of Human Rights, with a particular focus on the rights of women. The Assembly of Heads of State will take place between July 17th and 18th. Also of interest at this year's meeting is the fact that current AU Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma of South Africa has decided not to seek a second term. There is speculation that Botswana, Equatorial Guinea, and Uganda will put forward the names of their foreign ministers to succeed Dlamini Zuma. But Nigerian-born Chika Onuyeni, publisher and editor-in-chief of the African Sun-Times newspaper, says there should be a democracy litmus test for the countries whose candidates are running to succeed her. He said totalitarian leaders should not be rewarded with the position of chairperson of the AU. We need the chairperson of the African Union to be credible. If you nominate a candidate who represents one of those dictatorial leaders, what is going to happen is that you are enabling dictatorship in Africa, and that is not good for the continent, he said. Onuyeni said Dlamini Zuma's successor should be an individual who has demonstrated exemplary leadership in terms of respecting the constitution of his or her country, especially in observing term limits and holding credible elections and allowing the opposition equal access to the media. He said Uganda and Equatorial Guinea should not be rewarded because their leaders are dictators, despite the fact that Uganda held elections earlier this year.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.